I've entitled today's message, The Description of and Certainty of God's Judgment on Nineveh, and we'll be looking at Nahum chapters 2 and 3. But first, before we get into our study today, I would like to go back and just correct something I had said last time, and this was on the top of your notes on page 2, if you still have them. I had mentioned that we would go back and look at 2 Kings chapter 18 and 19, describing how wicked King Sennacherib of Assyria decided to terrify Jerusalem, and we looked at that passage, but I had said that it took place chronologically after the prophecy in Nahum. It actually takes place before the prophecy in Nahum, and so I put together a timeline which you should have in front of you. I just wanted to spend a little bit of time going through that. It does not have all of the events that take place, obviously, but it does have some of the major ones on the right-hand side. And then on the left side are listed the kings of Assyria in order. So starting at Shalmaneser III, he reigned from 859 to 824 BC, and so forth, all the way down to Ashur-uballit II, who reigned from 612 to 609 BC at the bottom left. Then you have in the center some kings of Judah that were in power during the times of the kings of Assyria. So you can see how they sort of overlap. So you have Jotham from 750 to 735 was his reign. And then Ahaz reigned from 732 to 715. And then after him was Hezekiah, and that's the king described in 2 Kings chapter 19 that we saw last time, interacting with Sennacherib as he surrounded Jerusalem. Hezekiah reigned from 715 to 686, and then there was some overlap between Hezekiah and Manasseh. That's why the two boxes are somewhat overlapping. That's not a mistake. And Manasseh reigned from 697 to 642. And then you have the small box below Manasseh, which is the writing of Nahum. And if you recall, we reviewed that in the first treatment of Nahum, looking at chapter 1, where we said that the fall of Thebes took place in Egypt at 663, in 663 BC. So we know that date. And we also know that Nineveh fell to the Babylonians in 612 BC, which is on the lower right-hand side there, to the Babylonians, Medes, and Scythians. So we know that Nahum was written sometime between those two events, 663 BC and 612 BC. And those obviously took place after Sennacherib died in 681. So if you look at the row where it says Sennacherib, the king of Assyria on the left, he reigned from 705 to 681. So Nahum was definitely written after he was king of Assyria. Let's just go through the events now listed on the right-hand side just to kind of orient ourselves a little bit more. So we have the first event occurring during the reign of Shalmaneser III. He attacked Israel and received tribute from Jehu, king of Israel. So we talked about how Israel was subservient to the Assyrians, and that was one of the issues there. They were receiving, they were sending tributes to Assyria, payment basically, at the demands of the Assyrians to this king, starting way back in the reign of Shalmaneser during 859 to 824 BC. Then in 772, we have evidence that the Assyrians committed atrocities in Israel, and they destroyed the northern kingdom. That was under the, between the rules, really, of Shalmaneser the IV and Ashur-dan the III. And then we have Jonah preaching to Nineveh after that during the reign of Ashur-dan the III. So again, that was around 100 years before the events that we or before Nahum was written, a good span of time between those two. Then going down to the next era, we have, as I mentioned, in 705, Assyria had surrounded Jerusalem. But that's when we read last time, the angel of the Lord put to death 185,000 of the Assyrian men in the army, put them to death overnight, and saved Jerusalem from that attack. Then in 681, we know that Sennacherib was murdered by his own sons, and we saw that in 2 Kings 19 last time. And then following that is the fall of Thebes in Egypt in 663. As I mentioned, the writing of Nahum fell between that and the final event listed here, which is the fall of Nineveh. So at the bottom, I've just made a footnote that says the time between Jerusalem being surrounded and the writing of Nahum could have been anywhere from 42 years minimum to 93 years if we just do the math between 705 and 663, or between 705 and 612. So just some additional information for you. Please read that and review it, and if you have any other questions, you can research that or let me know. All right. Please refer back to your notes then for today's message. Again, we're looking at Nahum chapters 2 and 3. We'll most likely only get to chapter 2 today. Until now, the prophet used mostly general descriptions about the judgment on the great city of Nineveh. However, beginning in chapter 2, Nahum gives much more detailed descriptions of the specific events, particularly about the siege, the fall, the plundering, and the humiliation of Nineveh. And Nahum's words probably also would have emboldened Judah's faith. So remember, that's an underlying goal of the book of Nahum, was to encourage Judah. So the words that Nahum wrote would have emboldened Judah's faith and encouraged them after they had been oppressed for so long by their adversary. And we saw by the chart we just looked at, going all the way back to 859 BC. So years and years of oppression. In addition to providing more details, Nahum's tone also changes from chapter 1, where we saw that he described the holiness of God at the beginning of chapter 1, and then the judgment of his enemies that must follow. And so in chapter 2, we find language that describes this raw emotion or chaos and the cruelty associated with battle. It really is striking language. There's also a keen sense of rapid movement and anxiety and the urgency in Nahum's portrayal of those realities of battle. And he depicts that in excruciating detail. I think that prophecies such as this, comprised of such detail, should instill in us an even greater appreciation for the Lord's omniscience, as he alone knows the future perfectly, and he alone brings about his will according to his plan for humanity. Let's look at our first point then, the description of God's judgment in chapter 2, and I'd like to read chapter 2 all the way to the end. So chapter 2 of Nahum, verse 1 says, "An attacker advances against you, Nineveh. Guard the fortress. Watch the road. Brace yourselves. Marshal all your strength." He's essentially saying that ironically to them. See all that you can do to try and protect yourselves, even though it will not be sufficient. Verse 2, "The Lord will restore the splendor of Jacob like the splendor of Israel, though destroyers have laid them waste and have ruined their vines. The shields of his soldiers are red. The warriors are clad in scarlet. The metal on the chariots flashes on the day they are made ready. The spears of pine are brandished. The chariots storm through the streets, rushing back and forth through the squares. They look like flaming torches. They dart about like lightning. He summons his picked troops, yet they stumble on their way. They dash to the city wall. The protective shield is put in place. The river gates are thrown open, and the palace collapses. It is decreed that the city will be exiled and carried away. Its slave girls moan like doves and beat upon their breasts. Nineveh is like a pool, and its water is draining away. Stop, stop, they cry, but no one turns back. Plunder the silver, plunder the gold. The supply is endless, the wealth from all its treasures. She is pillaged, plundered, stripped. Hearts melt, knees give way, bodies tremble. Every face grows pale. Where now is the lion's den? The place where they fed their young. Where the lion and lionesses went and the cubs with nothing to fear. The lion killed enough for his cubs and strangled the prey for his mate, filling his lairs with the kill and his dens with the prey. I am against you, declares the Lord Almighty. I will burn up your chariots in smoke, and the sword will devour your young lions. I will leave you no prey on the earth. The voices of your messengers will no longer be heard. All right, let's stop there for now. Our first point is Nineveh is taken. So the first seven verses in chapter 2 describe that event. Nahum warns Nineveh about an impending attacker in verse 1, which also means scatterer or disperser. He says, an attacker advances against you, Nineveh. And notice he's so confident about the invasion that he uses the present tense, advances. But we know that these things took place in the future. The Hebrew word literally means goes up and is used for hostile military operations. The attacker was ruthless and one who matched the Assyrians' brutality, namely Nabopolassar, the Babylonian, and Cyaxares, the Mede. Four imperative commands follow next that give some sense of the frantic activity as Nineveh tried to defend itself. And there's irony here, as though the Lord, through Nahum, was saying to Nineveh, do all that you can to protect yourself, but even that will not be enough to withstand your attacker. He says again, guard the fortress, verse 1, watch the road, brace yourselves, marshal all your strength. The splendor of the nation of Israel in verse 2, including Judah, the southern kingdom, and Israel, the northern kingdom, would be restored with the destruction of Nineveh. This is compared to their oppression, or contrasted with their oppression by Assyria, the destroyers, who laid waste to the northern kingdom in 722 BC, even destroying their grapevines. Verse 2 says, and have ruined their vines, just to emphasize the extent of the destruction. Then in verse 3, the red shields of the attacking soldiers, which were the Medes and Babylonians, were either from bloodstains, or perhaps their wooden shields were covered with red dyed leather, or possibly even copper, to give this reddish appearance. The mighty warriors approaching Nineveh's city walls undoubtedly were very impressive and intimidating to see. In their scarlet-colored uniforms as they advanced to confront the Ninevites. Verse 3 says, the shields of his soldiers are red. The warriors are clad in scarlet. The metal on the chariots flashes on the day they were made ready. They are made ready. The spears of pine are brandished. The attackers' chariots were drawn by horses and had metal gleaming in the sun, which flashed as they rushed back and forth through the streets and squares in preparation to breach the city wall. So this is still outside the city wall if you're thinking of the progression of events here. They're zooming back and forth as it describes. But their wooden spears were drawn, ready to engage the enemy. As they dashed around, they appeared like lightning or flaming torches to any onlookers. But the attackers still had not breached the city wall, so they must have been rapidly moving around the outskirts of the city in preparation for the gates to be opened, granting the invading army access to the city, which is really what they were after. O. Palmer Robertson, in his commentary on Nahum, describes the scene this way. They have laid claim to all the territory immediately outside the city walls, suburban roadway and intersections crisscrossing on the way to the various gates of the city are fully under occupation now. And think of, you know, this is a massive city, so think of the outskirts of the city beyond the wall as having quite a significant area and also population as well. The last resistance, Robertson goes on, has retreated behind the safety of the city's walls, and the fearful chariotry of the enemy rushes about securing every possible escape route. So they're planning to breach the gate. The he in verse 5 probably describes the Assyrian king summoning his troops to reinforce the city wall. We read in verse 5, he summons his picked troops, yet they stumble on their way. They dash to the city wall. The protective shield is put in place. They're dashing to the wall in a state of panic. His troops are stumbling along the way, and they need to reinforce the city wall by installing some type of protective shield in a final last-ditch effort to secure the wall from the advancing army. But it is too late and ineffective. Verse 6 then describes the actual breach of the city wall by flooding water directed into the city through the river gates. It says, the river gates are thrown open, verse 6 reads, and the palace collapses. Now there are several possible interpretations for the river gates, but commentators agree that the most supported by the language combined with the archaeological remains are that they refer to floodgates or sluices, and a sluice is like a gate on a lock, like on a river, such as the ones we have nearby here, and it controls the flow of water, be that river water or any other kind of water that passes through the city. So in this case, they were to control water upstream that would flow through the city. Now Robertson provides the following explanation for river gates. He says, more likely the gates of the rivers, that's in his translation, refer to the sluices which first would have been closed by the invaders and then opened so as to flood the wall of the city, breaking it through. This interpretation corresponds essentially with the testimony of Diodorus Siculus, an ancient Greek historian, who indicates that in the fall of Nineveh, a series of heavy rains swelled the Euphrates, which he points out is an error for Tigris, which flooded parts of the city and overthrew the wall for a length of about 2 miles or 20 stadia. So that was a significant event that compromised the security of Nineveh. The flooding was sufficient to breach the city wall, allowing the attackers to finally gain entry. Nineveh's exile was decreed by God in verse 7. It says, it is decreed that the city be exiled and carried away. Its slave girls moan like doves and beat upon their breasts. And we see here its slave girls moaning like doves as though they were lamenting over the prospect of going into exile by their attackers. So that is the first 7 verses describing the fall of Nineveh. Let's look at Nineveh being plundered next in verses 8 through 10. Nineveh is plundered. So their city is now infiltrated by water, literally like a pool. And we read in verse 8, Nineveh is like a pool and its water is draining away. Stop, stop, they cry. But no one turns back. But here the water is draining away describes the terrified Ninevites fleeing for their lives like water pouring out of a drain. Any possessions are left behind for the attackers. And despite some telling them to stop, and we are not told who is telling them to stop, it could be the invaders or it could be other Ninevites, but no one turns back. The remaining storehouses of silver and gold, including booty from all of the Assyrians' conquests. It would have also included tribute that had been paid to Nineveh, and probably along with articles acquired through their trading. So all of those storehouses of silver and gold were free for the taking, for the invaders. Nahum encourages the attackers to help themselves to the endless supply of wealth from all its treasures. Look at verse 9. Plunder the silver, plunder the gold. The supply is endless, the wealth from all its treasures, giving you some idea of the extraordinary wealth that Nineveh had acquired. Going on to verse 10, the city is described as pillaged, plundered, and stripped. It says, she is pillaged, plundered, stripped, hearts melt, knees give way, bodies tremble, every face grows pale. Elliot Johnson describes that the words pillaged, plundered, and stripped render three similar sounding Hebrew words. Because their wealth was being plundered and their lives were endangered, the Ninevites were frightened and they were really terror stricken. The Ninevites' terror is described at the end of verse 10 by those words, hearts melt, knees give way, bodies tremble, every face grows pale. The reality of the invaders triumphing set in, and you get a sense there of what went through their minds as they were being overtaken. So that is the description of the plundering of Nineveh. Next, let's look at Nineveh being humbled. Nineveh is humbled, verses 11 through 13. Nahum finished describing the siege by the attackers and the dramatic fall of Nineveh. Now in verses 11 to 13, he turns to use the symbolism of ferocious lions and a lion's den to taunt and mock the Ninevites with, where now is the lion's den? The once fierce invader that was accustomed to plundering other nations has herself now been the victim of an invasion and been the victim of plundering. Let's just look at those verses again. 11 through 13 says, where now is the lion's den, the place where they fed their young, where the lion and lioness went, and the cubs with nothing to fear? The lion killed enough for his cubs and strangled the prey for his mate, filling his lairs with the kill and his dens with the prey. I am against you, declares the Lord Almighty. I will burn up your chariots in smoke, and the sword will devour your young lions. Notice the reference there again to lions. I will leave you no prey on the earth. The voices of your messengers will no longer be heard. Robertson explains the symbolism this way. Extremely appropriate is the imagery of a den of lions for the royalty of Nineveh. The royally commissioned reliefs carved in stone depict repeatedly a number of lions. The kings of Nineveh often presented themselves in their annals in terms of reflecting the behavior of the lion. In addition, the Assyrians' cruel tearing of their enemies suits well the crushing assaults advanced by lions. So they liked to characterize themselves by the way lions behave, or the toughness and fierceness of lions. At one time, Nineveh had nothing to fear. As in verse 11, we see, where now is the lion's den? The end of the verse says, with nothing to fear. So that was their safe haven, their place of sanctuary and safety. So at one time, Nineveh had nothing to fear, like the safety and security of lions in their den. Now, they feared the Lord, for he was against them. Not unlike in chapter 1 and verse 14. Let's look at that quickly. 1 and verse 14 says, the Lord has given a command concerning you, Nineveh. You will have no descendants to bear your name. So the Lord speaks directly to them. And here again, he says, I am against you, in verse 13. What a fearful place to be, having the Lord against you. The Lord Almighty declares war against the Ninevites. Fire would destroy their chariots, which was their main instrument of war, and the sword would destroy their soldiers, or young lions, as it is referred to. They would no longer be able to attack defenseless nations, which would be their prey, nor send their messengers or heralds who once terrorized the earth by demanding tribute or demanding submission or blaspheming the Lord, as we saw last time in 2 Kings 19 and verse 22. Let's stop there for now and we will continue next time. Gracious God, we thank you for your omniscience, we thank you for your sovereignty, and we thank you that we have these words from Nahum to learn from, to learn more about you and how you deal with your people. In Jesus' name, amen.